Okay, well, it's a small enough group of us. Why don't we actually kind of change the energy of this instead of it being a little bit non-intimate? If you can fill the front seats and I'll come forward, it will be a little more connected. Yeah, more appropriate to who we are here. So please, in a way, you know, in theater, maybe some of you are familiar with this idea from contemporary theater or even television. They talk about breaking the fourth wall. Have you ever heard of that?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's where somebody admits that they're aware that there's a game being played, a performance, and then they speak through it like a real person to another real person, stepping out of their role into contact with the people in the audience. In a way, the whole theme of my book and my presentation is intending to break a variety of fourth walls that keep us pretending to be spectators when we're actually participants. Because we're all alive in a peculiar moment of a very pregnant moment in the whole human story. And pretending to be spectators is a big part of how we stay inauthentic. So, we also want to turn this not just into an intellectual lecture. I mean, I have a lot to say, and I make a lot of theoretical distinctions, but the essence of this is noticing that life is asking us to show up. Life is asking us to, in a sense, practice. You know, I'll say more about what practice is. But let's actually shift gears by doing a little bit of practice together, right here, right now. And one of the things that you may know, I've written the book Integral Life Practice with Ken and Adam Leonard and Marco Morelli. So I've done a lot of teaching of practice. So I want to invite you to shift gears into a practice mode. So if you don't mind standing up and emptying your hands, let's take a moment to kind of break into practice. Maybe stand with your toes and heels kind of close together, and your spine long. And relax your belly. Let your arms come loose. Maybe turn your palms a little bit forward. Close your eyes or let them come into a soft gaze. And notice the pressure of your weight on your feet, on the floor, in your shoes. Feel the qualities of earth, the solidity and stillness, weight of ground. Feel the qualities of light and freedom above your head. Relax your belly. Notice each breath you're being fed life energy, prana, aliveness. Each time you breathe in and each time you breathe out, you're able to surrender. and relax and expand. And just letting yourself soften and open and allow. Noticing the qualities in your being, qualities of awareness. And notice that there's a kind of a high frequency, constantly changing sensations, sound of my voice, air conditioning, a little ping from the phone, noises from outside the room. But then there's also this spacious field in which all that's arising. Even your breath is arising in this. Notice that it is beginningless, really, endless, and entirely okay. Utterly trusting and trustable. And as you breathe, release yourself more and more into contact with that quality of okayness and trust. And then start rolling your head in one direction. Careful to be doing this in a way that feels good in your body. Taking care of your well-being. And then roll your head in the other direction. And come back to center, and then roll your shoulders forward and up and back. And then in the other direction, coming forward from the back. Then open your wrists out and in. Your elbows out and in. And put your hands on your hips and circulate those, first in one direction, nice, and then the other. And then bringing your toes and heels together, putting your hands on your knees, do a knee circle to the right and to the left. Embracing your hands on your thighs, come forward with your back straight. Even arched a little bit, stretching your hamstrings. Intensify that stretch by bending your right knee and isolating the stretch along the back of your left leg. And wiggling a little so you distribute the stretch across the hamstring, and then switch legs, straightening the right. Stretching there. And then bend both knees and round your back and come forward, folding your arms. And let your weight of your arms and head lengthen your vertebrae, opening your spine. Nodding your head yes and no, shaking it no, letting the head hang. And then reaching your arms low, grabbing the hem of your imaginary nightgown, and let's all get naked, take off that nightgown, stretching up and stretching as if you're picking grapes, back and forth, stretching the sides of the body. Good, and then opening your stance, and if you have space, you can kind of maybe stretch forward like a chopping wood. And then sweeping your arms wide and up the center like a fountain. Just a few of these. And shake that water off your hands. Nice. And make a loose fist. Let's wake up. Stimulate the chi coming up the inside of your left arm and then up to your neck, the outside of the arm, switching over, up to your neck, coming down the outside, and then you can open your hands where you need to. Let's wake up our bellies. Coming up. Men be Tarzan, women be careful. And your low back and kidneys and going down the back, your legs, up the sides, down the front, up the inside, back to the side. Okay, now let's wake up our heads. And get every square centimeter of your cranium. And finish by slapping your forehead and your cheeks. And then feet about shoulder length apart, loosening your arms. And then take a deep breath and vocalize and do the silly shake. Good, and then let your arms float out a little from the side and feel the tingling of the whole body. Feel into the energy body extending from the whole surface of the skin out into space through your clothes. Feeling down into the earth energy, up into the sky energy, and out, feeling this bigness of your energy body, big, open like the Michelin Man, and breathing in and out, being fed and releasing. And then notice that we all touch in this energy domain. If we did a sensitive enough measurement of our brain waves, we could locate the heartbeat of one another in our brain waves. In this energy domain, we're not entirely separate. And then open your eyes and look out and see if you can see me and the other people in the room as if we are not entirely separate. And maybe we are only apparently separate. Feel that. And open your feet a little wider, your arms a little wider, like a big five-pointed star. And smile. See if you can smile with your heart, with the palms of your hands. Can you smile with the palms of your hands? Smile with your face. Smile with your feet. Smile with your genitals. Smile with your spine. And breathe and see if you can find an authentic yes. And thank you to this day, to this life, to everything that is easy and pleasurable, to everything that is challenging and hard. Find that yes. And relax and relax and relax. And then let's sit down and just do a short meditation. One of the things I innovated in integral life practice is what I call transrational prayer. You may be familiar with the idea of the three faces of spirit, three faces of God. And the I am-ness is the first person contemplating nature or philosophy, seeing it as third person, but turning to the mystery as you, the beloved, is the second person. So I invite you to maybe your beloved is right here before you. Maybe you can sympathetically tune in to these words. You who is beating this heart. You who is the very heart of every heart. You who is the very consciousness of this consciousness that cognizes these words, hearing them or speaking them. You who are being each and all. Thank you. Even one moment of this amazing conscious embodied experience is a gift. So profound, so precious. Please help me to awaken from my numbness, my mental fixation. Awaken to the miracle of you, the living God who is being this moment, the infinite depth of this and every moment. Please help open my ears to your voice. Open my eyes to the luminous sacredness that you are. Please help me to notice that below the problem I tend to think I have, you are here and there is no problem. Could not be. Thank you. Thank you. Please help us to sit here for just a few minutes of silence and deepening. Please stand forth potently as every sound, every sensation, but especially as the space, the sacred, infinite depth of this moment. And this of every new now. 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 May our consciousness and our behavior be of service to all beings and all patterns of being, liberating all into the heart of the mystery of this and every moment. Okay. So please open your eyes, come into the room. I want to give you folks a little talk about the basic, a few of the core ideas of my new book. Maybe also meet you all a little bit. And maybe we can do some experiential exercises too. We have 2.5 hours to do this. So, how many of you have noticed that human civilization seems to be coming unraveled?
And that word, last word.
Coming unraveled, falling apart.
Disintegrating.
That we have a crisis at the level of human civilization itself. Most of us seem to have noticed something like this. And it's very paradoxical, isn't it, that we are able to think about this because we were lucky enough to live in a time of peace and tranquility and enough prosperity and mobility and access to information, to where we can look at the images in the Hubble telescope, we can look back billions of years at the history of the cosmos, the planet. And yet part of it is we live these lifestyles where we burned a bunch of carbon to all be in the room together. And we want to be part of the solution, but we can't help but be part of the problem. And that's okay. There can't be a problem with all that, but is the biggest problem that the great neoliberal project that was going to create globalization and evidence-based rational decision-making for collective governance, that's coming off the rails? Or is the big problem really much more fundamental, the ecological predicament? Supposedly, the carbon we've already put into the atmosphere will create warming trends so much that our great-great-grandchildren won't even have human-friendly conditions except in the polar regions. And during most of the conference, even in this very enlightened gathering, awake to spiritual and intellectual, most people won't speak about the severity of this. It will be like we will act as though it's not happening. Even here, in the rest of the world, even way worse. Here, much more conscious than 98% or something, you know. But even here. And so that's the question that kept coming up for me. I kept feeling like I wasn't having getting down to it. You know, one of the things that makes a conversation authentic is if if you say the thing that's under the surface. You and your friend are competing for a promotion. If you don't talk about it, it's an inauthentic conversation. If you and your spouse are having tensions over sex in your relationship and you don't talk about it, then it's in the room, you know, silent in the way. Eh? When you talk about what's in the space that isn't being spoken to, that's when you make it get real. It becomes an authentic conversation. And we've got a situation, I think, where I just found myself feeling, you know, the complexity of our world has gotten so great that we need more powerful lenses, like all quadrant, all level integral theory, like evolutionary view, a process view. You know, the big point of evolutionary view is that it's not, our language is all set up for, you know, subject, verb, object, you know, noun, verb, noun. But all the nouns we now discover more and more are processes themselves. All the things are actually processes. It's all verbs. Verb, verb, verb. Systems, processes, in process with other processes. Carter Phipps calls it breaking the spell of solidity in his book, Evolutionaries. We begin to realize that everything is evolving and that even our me, I'm a process of processes. You're a process of processes. Sometimes I'm separate from you and I need to be self-responsible. Sometimes we're actually not even separate. How is that? How can we be with all that complexity and talk to what's really going on? These are the questions that were working me when I began to conceive this book and begin to write it. So, there are a few enough of us here that I'd like to kind of change the energy a little bit by inviting each of you to speak very briefly, because there's enough that if we talk at any length, it'll take too long. But please say your name and where you're from, and just a couple words about why you're here in this room right now. Would you be willing to do that? Could you start out?
Yeah, so my name is Stuart. I'm from Totnes in the southwest of England. Hello, Steve.
Hello.
And why am I here? I'm very alive to the questions that you articulate.
Great.
Yeah, so something about decline and collapse, and I sense these potential scenarios grief about that.
Yeah, thanks, Stuart. Jeff?
Hi, I'm Jeff, and I'm from Seattle, and my initial impulse to be here was just to be hang around with you, and then as soon as I decided to come here, I realized that it was an expression of my care for our human predicament, and I felt relieved to actually be able to be in this conversation this morning.
Fantastic, thanks.
Hi. My name's Carol, and I live in Harmony, literally, but not figuratively.
And, Harmony, Indiana?
In Florida.
Oh, okay.
USA. And I'm here because I want to know more about what you have to say, and like Stuart and like Jeff, well, what they said.
Cool.
Hi, I'm Antoine. I'm coming from Brittany, which is Western France. I am volunteering at IAPCM. I don't have my white t-shirt yet, so I will get it. And I'm coming here because Integral is related with my studies. I'm doing a Bachelor of Arts, I'm pursuing a Bachelor of Arts degree. So I'm here to learn about Integral practicing.
My name is Daniel. from Colombia. I live in Qatar in the Middle East. And one of the reasons I'm here is because my heart is broken and I'm not sure what to do about it.
Hello, my name is Andy. I'm from Munich, Germany. And I'm here, I think, first of all, I'm here because I wanted to meet you in person, because I think like what you did with Inner Life Practice is like very important work and very inspiring. And then I heard like a few podcasts or like saw like you having interviews on YouTube about the New Republic of the Heart. I haven't read, to be honest, and I haven't really understood the like the severity you're describing in these interviews, and I just wanted to learn more about the message.
Thanks, Andres.
My name is Joachim Berggren. I'm from Stockholm, Sweden. And one part that I'm here is to make my friend Henrik envious, because he has not arrived yet. And he really likes your work. And because he really likes your work, I also sort of want to check in.
Fair enough.
My name is Walter Urbanik. I'm from Vienna, Austria. I'm a long-time reader and follower of Ken Wilber, and I do integral practice and do the Integral Salon in Vienna. And I'm a member of a big co-housing project in Vienna with 200 people, kind of integral spirituality there. And I'm engaged in making the city a green city, decarbonization of our community.
Beautiful, thank you.
I'm Mary Kennedy, I'm from Dublin, and I'm here because from my own perspective, the heart is the only way through the complexity that I can find. My mind isn't capable of navigating it, and also because you were the first integral workshop I ever did when you came to Dublin.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I don't know how long ago, that's a while ago, but yeah.
Yeah, so, quite a while ago.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Nice to see you again.
My name is Hans-Gunnar Andén. I'm from Stockholm, Sweden as well. And well, I've been interested in integral theory for many decades already. And now that I'm retired, I'm looking for some inspiration for, well, that can help me show up.
Fantastic.
I'm Steve, also from Totnes in England, and I read your book, and it was the first time I'd heard James Hillman and Ken Wilber synthesized, which has been sort of a question for me ever since I read Ken Wilber. So that was a kind of aha moment. So that feels the experience of the earth as a unity is a kind of guiding thing in my life. I don't know why, but so when you know, these questions about climate change and humanity experiencing itself as a whole, experiencing the earth as a whole, and I wanted to meet you in person as well, and I've done some of your online course.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Steve?
Yeah. Thanks.
My name is Gerald. As I say, I'm the only Hungarian in this room. I'm a clinical psychologist and researcher in the field of obesity, so the overweight population. And I'm also very interested in the integral approach. And I'm here to have you in this lecture.
Very good. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Anne. I'm from Ghent, Belgium. And we are reading Ken Wilber's text and integral stuff already a long time, and of course we know each other, so I wanted to reconnect. I haven't read the book, I've seen quite a few of the clips and the interviews, but I wanted to know more about it.
Great.
My name is Hans, from Ghent, Belgium as well, and I'm here to be with you and definitely to celebrate your new masterpiece.
Wonderful, thanks, Hans.
So I'm Jochen from Düsseldorf in Germany. and I'm a disciple from Terry, an integral practitioner since a long time. And Terry is my most integral teacher, so to say, and I'm here to say thank you for your work, what you're doing, and also to share my personal struggle with this whole topic, to see this and to live this paradoxical life. I'm really in it and I'm aware of it, and I'm struggling to find my way and our way to apply and adjust more integral. So that is my and our core.
Barbara, I am from Alexandria, Virginia, right across the Potomac River from Washington, D.C. in the USA. And I can see the capital of the United States out my bedroom window. And sometimes all that does is trigger me to pray. Because my heart is breaking. And I'm here for the I too, along with Hans and Jochen, have been a long time follower. I'm here to get the dose of reality and to talk authentically, and I know you will do that, and also to listen so that I can, in my retirement, figure out how I might show up.
Beautiful. Thanks. Well, here we are. Alive and conscious in the midst of the chaos of experience. I want to tell you guys a little more about me. Some of you know these things, but it might be kind of useful to share a little about my personal history. When I was 6 years old, my parents moved from the south side of Chicago into the York Center Community Co-op. It was a cooperative community that was founded by members of the Church of the Brethren, which is one of the three so-called peace churches in America that are the basis for why there is a conscientious objector status, so that when young men were drafted, some people in these churches could do an alternative service because they are nonviolent churches. And these people in the Brethren Church wanted to own their homes cooperatively and have a richer community life. So although each family had their own building, their own home, they were work bees and committee meetings, and they managed their common life together. And they invited people of other races and religions to live together with them as a witness for peace and brotherhood. So as I was growing up, my friends' parents and my parents' friends were, some of them African-American, some of them, like my family, was half Jewish and half not Jewish. There were Japanese-Americans who had been in the internment camps. It was and quite a few people that were very involved in the peace movement, of course, because of the pacifist origins, but also the civil rights. And this was during the Vietnam years. So I was kind of the kid in that generation who was most interested in current events and politics. And so I ended up getting mentored by all these co-op aunts and uncles in becoming a radical, a revolutionary. So I founded an underground newspaper at my high school, and I became the SDS regional coordinator, and I was involved with Chicago area draft resistors, and we marched and demonstrated at the Democratic Convention in 1968, and I went to Ann Arbor, Michigan, where I led several student demonstrations. We occupied several buildings. We had quite an exciting time during those years, and yet at the peak of it, I began to realize that the revolution that I thought we could enact externally really had to come from our very way of being, that I wasn't being peace, I wasn't being love, and that had to change if I wanted to have any integrity in doing this outer work. The inner work had to also be real. My friends in the co-op, my parents' friends, some of them had a kind of religious basis, but none of them had a deep practice of meditation. They didn't have the awakenings of the higher states and samadhis and so forth. And I wanted to wake up in that way too. I didn't want to just have it only in the social world. So I found my way, well, you know, it was a gradual process. It began by me realizing I had to change, getting into therapy, discovering the human potential movement, getting quite involved in that, but finally finding my way to Adi Da Samraj, who was my guru, my root guru, and I spent 15 years from the age of 22 to 37 deeply involved as a committed practitioner in that ashram. But over time, the ashram life became more of a, you know, conventional guru worship, and it was more conformist, and I finally felt that for me to really make a contribution that wasn't just going to be isolated in this little ashram world, I had to break out of it. So I did. For the next 10 years, the first thing that, well, we had some adventures. My wife and I sold everything we owned, put a little bit of stuff into storage, and bought one-way tickets to Hong Kong and wandered around Asia for a while. That was kind of a fun adventure. But it didn't take long for us to co-author a book out of which we started a business. And we created in the United States the first place that all the consciousness technologies, this is stuff like Holosync or profound meditation, all that kind of stuff, home EEG devices. We had a 100-page color catalog. So I was a businessman for 10 years doing that. Then I sold that business, and I went into writing a book that I really felt I wanted to write. And I worked on it quite intensively and finally had a draft of it. That was when I first met Jeff. And I brought that actually to a meeting that Pacific Integral's first GTC program, and flew directly from that to Colorado, where I met Ken Wilber, and I gave him a copy of it. And I didn't publish that book. I ended up getting involved with Ken and Integral Institute. We created Integral Life Practice. I began teaching Integral Life Practice. What that book wanted to do, it was an earlier, and in many ways it was I'm still not ashamed of that book, but it wasn't a mature integration. In that version of the book, the 2004 edition, it was called The Terrible Truth and the Wonderful Secret, Answering the Call of Our Evolutionary Emergency. So it clearly was about this topic, but it was at a time when I naively believed that integral approaches had all the answers to a degree beyond what I now realize more of what needs to be integrated for a true integration. So I never published that book. I instead got involved in the world that you guys know me from and my whole career of teaching integral practice and writing the kind of papers that some of you have seen, you know, has happened. That's the last 15 years. But all this time I had wanted to speak to this elephant in the room, which to me had always been, you know, we try to talk about what the essence of the crisis is, but I like what Sean Esbjorn Hargens has done by calling it a meta crisis. By that, he's really saying, you know, along the lines of what he wrote about with Michael Zimmerman in Integral Ecology, there's a, you've probably heard of integral ontological pluralism, the idea being that when we look at things from one perspective or another perspective, it becomes a different thing. So the thing itself, the idea that there's a knowable single reality that we're just looking at from a variety of perspectives, gets exploded, and we begin to realize that reality itself is ambiguous, and, you know, in a sense, the thing we're looking at is not exactly one thing. You know, it's a cluster of possibilities. Well, the crisis is many things at once. In a way, and I think if we get down to the very nub of it, What is the bottom line of this crisis? We could say from many perspectives that it's an ecological predicament. And there's an analysis around what that is that would say any ecosystem, say a pond or an island, has a carrying capacity for any life form. So if in this pond can naturally support a certain population of algae. But if in the fall a whole bunch of leaves fall into the pond and they decompose, at a certain point they've decomposed enough that they become good food for algae, and then all of a sudden you get this huge population of algae, right? And the whole pond is green and thick with algae. But then after a while, all the algae dies off and turns brown, right? Because it can't permanently support that much. It's had this expansion of what it can support, but what it can permanently support is a lower volume. There's a certain permanent carrying capacity. So deep ecologists, and pretty much a huge community of scientists and ecologists, have a simple analysis of what's happened on our planet, which is that we are like the algae bloom right now. We have 7.5 billion of us, and particularly with the lifestyles that we're living, we can't support that. So we are now very ingeniously using up our non-renewable resources, and we are degrading the renewable, the life cycles that create renewable resources. We're maxing them out to a degree that degrades certain of the elements of those regenerative processes get degraded enough that they would even if they have a chance to bounce back, they wouldn't bounce back to where they could have been before. That their ultimate levels are being reduced. You see? So not just the non-renewable, but even the renewable carrying capacity of the Earth is being reduced by the way we're maxing it out right now. So that this is a condition they call overshoot. It's a technical term in ecological theory that basically talks about when you've overshot your carrying capacity and you begin to degrade the permanent carrying capacity. So once you have overshoot, then you have collapse. Overshoot is when the algae bloom has taken over the pond. Collapse is when the algae all turns brown, sinks to the bottom. And this is a predictable thing. It's known in ecological science. So there's a lot of folks. There's a huge community. They're not in the integral community, but they're intelligent people who are thinking very seriously about the human future, who have concluded that we're in this condition of overshoot and that we're headed for collapse, and there's really not a lot that can be done about it. I was just reading a very intelligent article that was written just a couple of weeks ago by a thinker in that world who was arguing, he was saying, some of the people in our movement think that we're inevitably going to see human extinction as a result of these things. But another group believes that, yes, we're going to have the collapse of human civilization, but it really won't have to lead to extinction. And that was what they're debating. Are we all going to die completely, or are we just going to go to some sort of dystopian kind of Mad Max sort of situation? In their world, those are the only realistic alternatives. They're that pessimistic. Okay, that's what they're thinking. Now, that's a minority. One of the things that I look at is, well, what do most people think? How are we coping with what is real? And from what I can see, maybe something like 90%, roughly, I don't really know the exact, but you know, vast majority of people believe that we will have technological breakthroughs that will remake the map and that we will make somehow make it through this squeeze, this seeming overshoot. And this line of thought is techno-optimism. But based on that techno-optimism, our whole culture, like, you know, in the United States, I stay abreast of current popular intellectual discussions of what's happening. And most people, including most scientists, are not thinking that the ecological emergency is nearly that dire. And yet, they're not really reckoning with the implications of the climate science. So in my view, they're in denial. The culture as a whole has many people who say, oh, climate change is real, and it's human caused, and it's serious, and we need to do something about it. But they don't add it all up to the point of seeing that it creates an existential crisis at the deep level that it does. They don't face those implications. So that's what I would call denial. We're in a culture, and this extends, I think in Europe there's more awareness, a little less denial than there is in the United States. But even here, I think most people are in denial. There was an interesting article recently in the New Yorker magazine by Bill McKibben, the founder of 350.org, in which he described a recent visit to Japan, and he talked about having been in Kyoto and in Hiroshima. And in Hiroshima, looking at the museum about the nuclear blast, he was reflecting how the people can see this mushroom cloud and this vast destruction, and they can say, yes, there's this is horrible, let's prevent this. It's the mind can wrap itself around it. But Kyoto was where we had the, I think, 92 protocols for reducing carbon emissions. And of course, nothing happened. People heralded it as a great breakthrough. We've looked even at what has happened now with the more recent Paris Accords, which of course Trump has withdrawn the U.S. from. And what he was pointing out was very interesting. He said, on any given day in the United States, you have whatever it might have been, 200 trillion explosions of gasoline in internal combustion engines or in turbines driving electrical generation systems, powered by fossil fuels. And that this is actually the most important and consequential thing that is happening on any given day. But the news never covers that. The news is always covering, there's been a school shooting in Texas, or there's a, the particulars of news items that draw people's attention.
The royal wedding.
The royal wedding. Absolutely. Non-stop coverage, and so he was pointing out this distortion field in which we can't seem to see the things that are really important, but that are, you know, this has to do with what's called signal and noise, or ground and field. Attention goes to the thing that changes, the thing that's always the same, never attracts attention. And these things that are always the same about our way of life are the critical issues. So 90% of people effectively then are in denial and acting as though we're not in a crisis. 10% or so get that we're in a crisis, but they think that they know that we're headed for disaster. And I disagree with both of these points of view. I want to offer a different perspective. As integralists, we are more aware. This is the place where we are way ahead of everybody else. We know that the history of the whole evolutionary process, cosmic evolution, biological evolution, cultural evolution, has been emergence. That means things have happened that couldn't have been predicted from what went before. That's a miracle. life from inanimate matter, miracle. Consciousness from vegetative life, a miracle. You know, like the summary of the evolutionary process that Brian Swim offers. If you leave hydrogen and helium alone long enough, eventually they build cathedrals and write symphonies. That's one way of putting it. So the whole history of evolution has been miracle after miracle. Why do we assume that there won't be any miracles in the time ahead? Especially when we know that scientific advance is exponential. Exponential growth is very hard for the human imagination to grok. Those of you who followed transhumanist thinking, like Ray Kurzweil, has made an entire career on helping people recognize how counterintuitive exponential advance is. Exponential advance of technology, according to him, is going to create godlike superintelligence, a singularity that's going to transform everything. Soon we will have machines capable of, intelligent machines, capable of designing even more super intelligent machines that will be capable of tackling all the problems that human beings can't deal with, and we're going to see a transformed world. That's that argument. Now we have another counterargument, though, that's even more sophisticated to that. There was a very important book published earlier in last year, in 2017, by a man named Jeffrey West. He was the director of the Santa Fe Institute. And his book is called Scale. And in it, he's a physicist, but he decided that the tools of physics, which really kind of have to do, you know, physics is very closely married to math. So the analytical tools of physics take a look at proportions and ratios and fundamental laws of dynamics. So he applied this to life forms and life spans and size and metabolic rate, and he applied it to social systems, and he applied it to the history of innovation, what we integralists would call the revolutions in the lower right. So in the lower right, you know, we were sort of ape-like, and then we began to build tools. We had a technological revolution, came from the first stone tools. And then there were various advances as we got into the Bronze and Iron Ages and so forth. But before that, we had the agricultural revolution. So we've had a series of these revolutions that transformed things. And he observed, gosh, they get bigger and bigger and bigger in their consequences, and they happen faster and faster and faster. He did what he could to quantify them using the tools of physics, and he took a look at where they were at on the time span. And he noticed, this is a self-accelerating cycle. And a self-accelerating cycle has some real structural problems, because you can't keep going faster and faster and faster. If you go faster and faster and faster, it implies a time singularity. It goes, okay, it's slow, and then it's a little faster and faster. But then faster, 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 faster. You can't, if you keep going faster, it stops, right? Faster and faster implies an end point. And so he looked at this very seriously. He ended up saying, wow, we're caught in a self-terminating dynamic. Even, you know, and he's saying something kind of radical, because what he's saying is, even if we figured out a way to generate energy that was completely clean, no carbon, and we had a way to do large-scale carbon precipitation and sequestration, and we could solve the whole climate emergency 100%. Let's just, as a thought experiment, imagine that that's possible. He's arguing that there's something even more fundamental about our technological acceleration that would be self-terminating anyway. That it's not only rooted in the overshoot hypothesis, that it's more inherent to a self-accelerating dynamic. which was really interesting to me because I really paid attention to that. That was a super important idea. But a year before, I had interviewed the futurist Peter Russell. Some of you heard of Peter. He wrote the book, there's the Brain book, and then the Global Brain Awakens, Waking Up in Time, White Hole in Time, a whole series of futuristic books, an evolutionary thinker and a brilliant guy. And he had been very quietly on his website publishing a book he called Blind Spot. He wasn't using the tools of physics to do an analysis, but he was coming up with this same idea, that this self-accelerating dynamic would be self-terminating by its very structure. And he thought that maybe we can make it through global warming, but we can't make it through this technological turn. And I had a very tender and beautiful dialogue with him on my Beyond Awakening series. The title of it was, Supposing It's Too Late, What Then? And so it was a deep contemplation of, okay, well, let's suppose that it's too late. Let's have that thought experiment. In a way, if we're so afraid that it's, you know, there's a tremendous value in planning to look at worst case scenarios. Because if you can face the worst case scenario and you can come to a resolution that you can live with, that gives you, you know, that you're not afraid of, right? And you're looking at the worst case, then you can look at anything. Then you've become, in a sense, grounded in something that's equal to the tasks, whatever they are. And what Peter had come to was a very sweet thing, because he said, gosh, for years I have been so angry at these stupid people who can't see the writing on the wall, and suddenly I'm forgiving it all. Oh, they couldn't have done any better. That's just inherent in the way things are. And his heart just softened in relation to all of, he said, no, we're all caught in something bigger than ourselves. And so there was just this marvelous softening and forgiving that was going on. And he also came to a sense of, yes, well, but we, you know, the world is beautiful, the day is gorgeous, you know, each day is a gift. The miracle of life is still here. And whatever life we're given is an opportunity to realize and recognize and celebrate and serve the inherent beauty and goodness of existence anyway. When I talked with him, I compared this to an idea in Jewish mysticism, in the Kabbalistic thought, where they talk about what really matters is how you write your name in the book of life. So the way you live is a inscription, you might say, in the eternal, you know, in some theories of advanced physics, you know, time is not real, all time is simultaneous. In a way, this is, you know, everything has already died. This is the other world. We're in this other relationship to it all. You have already, you know, the sequential way of conceiving things that's native to our body minds and our perspectives and points of view is kind of dissolved, and everything is just what it is. And then there is this opportunity to live our values the best we can, right? To be love in whatever ways we can, to be the truth of our existence, to know the truth of our existence. We have, I mean, think about what it's like to be us. For this particular time, like, we live in this time where we have all these images, like from the Hubble, and we're about to get even more amazing images from the new telescope that's being launched, which is, what is it called? I'm forgetting the name. There's another great astronomer whose name is attached to the next even better telescope that's going to show us even more amazing stuff about the, you know, we live in the time in which evolution, I mean, the hydrogen and helium that was left alone long enough to build the cathedrals and write the symphonies is also putting telescopes into our orbit and wondering about the meaning of it all, right? It's that's what evolution does, and the eyes of evolution are seeing itself as never before through us. We are the ones who are here now in this time of miracles and marvels. We're not only seeing that we might be involved in a self-terminating, it's a glorious self-terminating process if it's, you know, it, maybe it's self-terminating, but wow, right? And we are it doing its thing right now, recognizing, as we are recognizing, oh, you know, maybe this whole game of opposition and grief and, oh no, things are not the way they should, maybe that's just a false narrative we're laying onto something. Maybe this, maybe being with this in a more profoundly accepting and joyous way is really the secret of it. So, to me, the implications of this contemplation are that they're both profoundly heartbreaking and profoundly inspiring. Like it takes me out of a dry, abstracted, like I'm an engineer or, you know, an abstract scientist just looking at data. It takes me completely out of that to a place where the heart is primary. Where the fact that everything I love is threatened and I'm here and maybe I can do something about it, that's very real. But also that, what a glory, you know, like some part of me is amazed at the, wow. Like if I had been in some waiting room and God was saying, okay, so who wants to be born in the 1600s? Who wants to be born in the, you know, like, We hit the jackpot. We're here when reality is getting to see itself as never before. Everything is at stake, and there's zillions of us around, able to love. You know, we're not just getting the scientific knowledge. We're here in a time in which all the wisdom traditions of mankind are in dialogue with each other as never before, and in dialogue with evidence-based, rational, scientific reasoning. All of that is in discourse as it has never been before. And all of us, particularly here at this Integral Conference, we're in touch with the implications of that. I mean, our souls, in some sense, consented to be here now. Something in our being said yes. So this may seem in some ways overwhelming and impossible. How can you grok the potential mortality of so much of the living earth and us being the parasites that are devouring the host and destroying the life support system? And, you know, there's something kind of beyond horrible about that. And yet there's something also beyond beautiful. In some sense, some people would condemn, let me see if I can put these two points of view together. On one hand, it's good to just appreciate what a glory all that is. Somebody could look at you appreciating what a glory that is and say, hey, there's real suffering, real death, real destruction that matters. You know, Bill McKibben would say, drop what you're doing, get into the streets, make a difference about the politics of global warming. You know, he would say, just cut through this. There is a lot at stake. Don't just sit here and glory in the amazing vista that you get to view. Come on. So, and everybody's got a point. There's a wonderful, wonderful quote. It's such a simple quote, but think about it. Gertrude Stein, she said this in like the 20s, I think, or 30s. Everybody is right about everybody. That means that the person who's saying the important thing is to just appreciate the wonder and beauty and glory and heartbreaking gorgeousness of this amazing miracle that is life, they're right. But the person who's saying, hey, get off your ass and do something about it, they're right too. The person who is over here accepting everything and feeling grateful looks at him and says, hey, cognizing a problem and being in conflict with what is a really shitty way to relate to reality when there's a glorious essence here that cannot by its very nature be a problem. They're right too. Everybody's right about everybody. Now, can we be with all of that in a way that deepens us? I think that in one of the core takeaways of my book, and this takes a lot of depth to truly take away, is a shift from various modes of, you could call them modes of discourse. Like for instance, debate. In most academic conferences, you'll have somebody putting forward a thesis and other people kind of trying to shoot it down. There's an adversarial process in which the best idea wins out. If we try to critique it as much as possible and it survives the critique, maybe it has greater validity. And that's the theory why that's a good way to do discourse. So if you go to a scientific conference and somebody comes up with some new evidence and a new theory on the basis of it, the other guys are going to be saying, well, it seems good in this way, but your experimental design could have had this unconscious bias that created this distortion, and maybe your findings aren't really valid, right? That's the kind of discourse that goes on. I'm arguing for something else. I think that if we look at all this, we realize we're all in the same lifeboat, this planet, and the human civilizational structure that it involves. And it's facing real survival challenges that are unprecedented, and nobody knows how to solve all that. What's appropriate in the midst of that is a shared inquiry. And in a shared inquiry, I'm not interested in fact, conflict in a way is a problem. If we're all in the same lifeboat, fighting with each other is not how we make the lifeboat more seaworthy. Making the lifeboat more seaworthy is the overriding necessity. So how we are being with one another in the midst of it becomes critical. This matter of transitioning our relationships so that they're more genuinely generous, more genuinely altruistic, so that love is actually creating a survival opportunity, that becomes more important. So then the kind of discourse we want to engage in is a shared inquiry, where we have questions and challenges that nobody knows how to deal with. Well, here's some of what I think we need to take into account in order to ask these questions better. Okay, thank you, that's good, but we should also take these things into account. Yes, that's good. Okay, but then this question becomes important. That's right, but if we just focus on that question, we don't notice this. We kind of have to ask these questions together. You know, you're refining your inquiry. You're involved in a shared inquiry in which the quality of the inquiry is being refined. That's a much more appropriate form of discourse. In fact, I think we're at a point right now where debate itself is obsolete. Debate can only get us so far. And our habit of being involved in this kind of adversarial form of discourse and debate is part of what we're being asked to outgrow. So in fact, we talk about these things obviously the human species is being asked to evolve. We're going to evolve for sure. We're going to change. We're in a moment now where there will be miraculous advances. There will be horrific challenges. In either case, they're bigger disruptions than we've seen before. The intensification of fragmentation is itself destabilizing. But the kind of humanity that will be equal to this wondrous and terrible set of disruptive challenges is more than how we already know how to be. So we're being asked to outgrow the ways we know how to be. My very way of being, however wonderful it may be, however evolved it may be, has to keep evolving. I'm being asked to be more than what I already am. We are, and you are too. So now there's a different kind of discourse. Oh, I'm doing my best. How can I do it better? You're doing your best. How can you do it better? We're like asking these questions together. Is that me? No, good. We're all being, if we're in that question, it draws us into a more tender kind of contact with each other, doesn't it? Like, okay, I'm no longer presenting myself as if I have all the answers and I'm trying to persuade you of what I already know. I'm in my questions and you're in your questions. And I'm respecting your way of being in your questions and you're respecting mine. And we're partners now in a bigger set of questions about how we can be differently with each other. We're not used to that. It's very, very rare to have a human conversation in which there's enough shared understanding that people are trusting each other to contribute to, like where it's curiosity meeting curiosity in a context of mutual respect and also in which our tenderness is being presenced. How false could it be for us to have conversations about things that threaten the future of everything we love, and we talk about it as if it's an engineering problem? Yes, well, there's a limit on the resources. Let's get a numerical take on that. And we're all acting as if we're engineers in the control room. That is completely inauthentic. If everything that you care is threatened, your heart has to be present in that conversation. It's a different dynamic. It's got vulnerability. It's got humanity. So what this contemplation does is it draws us into an immediacy that asks us to change. Can we be in relation to each other in a way where the fact that we're all being asked to change has been downloaded deeply enough into our being that we're being with each other as an inquiry into how to be human in this momentous moment? And that is getting a chance to evolve. Well, that's a lot of what I explore. There's a chapter in this that's about a very deep look and I think a more advanced iteration of what an integral spiritual practice is. But then an exploration of how, in some sense, that's also about our own journey, our soul's journey, and the narratives that we tell ourselves. We're involved, in some sense, in a hero's journey here, a process of becoming what evolution somehow wanted to become. What was the purpose of evolution in the first place? You know, we could say, oh, there was some little tendency on the part of matter and energy to want to become self-aware. But not just to become self-aware, to somehow become, isn't a part of self being self-aware to be self-loving and self-actualizing and self-actualizing Like, evolution wants to keep evolving. Life wants to keep evolving. The part of me that wants to be part of how, can we turn this thing around? Maybe, maybe not, but I want to either turn it around or I want to be doing the thing that would have turned it around if it could have been turned around, right? And somehow the beauty of what it is to be human, like in Peter Russell's version, well, let's be whatever it is that's most beautiful about this whole way of being. So that lays out something of the depth of where I think we can hang with each other, perhaps. I have lots to say about this. I feel like that's one run at it, that it only takes into account really less than a quarter of what's there in the book. But it is about some of the essentials. And I want to give you guys a chance to kind of respond to that, ask questions, engage me, so that we can kind of move the energy a little more. How are we doing? We're going to want to have a break here fairly soon. But let's have a little exchange of energy before we do that.
Yeah, I have a question because so far I think you described like the overall problem, like the overshoot and the climate change and all this like general problem that we are facing. And then now you also described like the hard part, I think, like having a look at the title of the book, I think this is what you've been describing over the last few minutes. But now, like, where comes the republic and revolutionaries like, into play? Like, what's this about?
Yeah. Well, I have a lot to say about that. That's not a short answer. But I promise to get into that after the break, for sure. It's, yeah, that's the work, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, what really struck me when you asked the question that Peter asked, is it, you know, what if it's too late? Just reminded me of the process I went through when my dad was dying. And the whole idea that doctors are giving you all the peace, but actually in his capacity as a dying man, he just brought the family into the most beautiful, human, tender place where he just started to speak how grateful he was for his life and for our life. And it just so reminded me of that it wasn't an ending. It was an ending, of course, and a heartbreak. And it reminded me of, I think it's a Tibetan meditation, which is death is certain. The time of death is uncertain. What shall I do? So it's not about sitting around and just being grateful that's not passive. But it's also about how can I spend the next 9 months with this man that is my life, that has been my life? How can I spend the next however long we have left on this earth, that I can connect with people in a way that if we didn't really have a crisis, I'm not sure we would connect. I don't know if that makes sense, but it was very strong for me when you were speaking of that.
Uh-huh.
That
in a way, just as our own death quickens the spiritual lesson of our whole life, our collective mortality quickens something about our evolutionary journey as a collective. Yeah.
And as a species, like even creatures.
Yeah. Yeah.
The contemplation is actually really for me where the work is. Can I contemplate that so I then enact something in my life from that contemplation? It's really powerful for me having gone through that. And that was the turn when you were talking about, yeah, okay, now you've got me.
Right.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for hanging at that level with it.
Yeah.
I really appreciate that. Carol?
I guess for about 90%+ of my life, I have lived with an armored heart, and which is pretty normal, and particularly in the United States, I think. And so for about the last year, I've been practicing with more of an open heart, open gut way of being. But when you first completed the meditation at the beginning, something that occurred to me was not just heart opening, but heart reaching out to touch other hearts. So thank you. it's an extension.
Mm. Yeah, and to receive them. Okay.
Can I say something?
Yeah.
That your some point in your talk, a question opened up for me, which is, it's something like, you know, when I really come in relationship to something that I've been avoiding, it often seems to have this experience of like, oh, I really get the pain that I was avoiding and understanding where it was coming from. It's like I understand now. And in understanding, I can actually come into relationship. And I realized something when you said that thing about, you know, our great-great-great-grandchildren will have to live in the polar ice caps or something like that. I thought about, well, okay, it kind of fried my brain a little bit, okay, well, this is not my kids. You know, like, that kind of makes sense to me in a way, like my care is, I can see my care in relationship to what's immediate to me. But there was this other kind of care, which has to do with like generational or humanity in general, or I don't quite fully understand the pain of that. The pain of what it is to care of generations out. I can get it conceptually, and I can feel the pain, but I'm not quite into that, like, oh, I really understand what that pain is. And it just, so it opened a question for me. I wonder if we explore what that pain is, if that would help us come in relationship.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I mean, there's one boundary which is, in, you know, profoundly egoic. Like, I care for my own experience to a degree I can't even care for the people I love the most. You know, like there's the self is the first ring, and then there's those that I'm really,
right,
you know, in touch with, like your own kids. But it becomes a little bit more abstract the further out we get. And what is it to have an embodied relationship to the care as it extends further and further from our immediate experience? Yeah. I like that. I think that's really worth it.
It's just it's a kind of vague question for me, which feels important to me.
Yeah, one of the things viewed from a systems perspective. By the way, there is one more idea I want to give you guys to have before we break. From a systems perspective, if you just look at evolutionary theory and what we see, you know, evolution proceeds by differentiation and reintegration. Evolution over time creates more and more articulation of particularity in the differentiation zone, but then it also creates more consciousness and more complexity, and it creates more cooperation. So there are patterns. What it would predict would be cooperative superorganisms of human beings, what I call communities of practice in this book, or tribes, but delimited numbers of people who are able to take a certain level of responsibility and who are able to throw their lot in with one another, such that together they have a better ability to cope with the challenges of life than any of them have as individuals. And those superorganisms would confer survival. So that would correspond to the eco-village monastery model, where maybe we go to a Mad Max world, but we have these little islands of sanity and love, but that are tough as nails on the outside and can like deal with the tough life conditions. But internally, everybody's really sharing in a much more profound way, and there's a quality of love of a different kind. That's one of the theories as to how things will unfold. and it is predictive of that. But all of these things require us to deal with really, I mean, friggin' global warming, what could be more abstract? It's odorless, it's invisible, it's you know, it's all so abstract, and yet we've got to take it into account. So that no wonder nobody's taken it into account. No wonder we're in denial, because nothing could be better designed to be hard for us to feel and in a grounded, embodied way. So of course we've got this mass hallucination going on.